Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with JCO editor Dr. Dan Haller for a tasting menu of clinical pearls in the way of two cases he prepared to discuss, which relate closely to emerging clinical research and implications for patient care. The first patient is a young woman who ended up entering a fascinating and very rational clinical trial.
She's a hockey gym teacher, which relates to some of the toxicity she's had with her treatment. A 45-year-old woman who presented with some rectal bleeding and a little bit of tenesmus had a tumor at about 7 centimeters, so it was high enough that she could have undergone primary surgery with a low anterior resection. But based on the German trial, most people are proposing neoadjuvant therapy, primarily because of toxicity issues.
Now, the German trial that you referred to, let me remind our listeners, was a relatively large study that randomized patients with rectal cancer to the same chemoradiation regimen, either pre- or post-op. The pre-op chemo group had a significantly lower rate of pelvic relapses, and there were no significant differences in overall or disease-free survival. But the acute and long-term toxicity was significantly lower in the pre-op chemo group. So back to your patient now. What kind of workup did she have?
She had endoscopic ultrasound, which showed that it was a T3N1 tumor. She had a CT scan of the abdomen, pelvis, and chest.
Agree or disagree, endorectal ultrasound is a critical part of the evaluation of a patient like this. And if people aren't prepared to do it, they should send the patient elsewhere.
Agree and agree. We know that it is not perfect, that it typically overstates the T stage and understates the N stage. But in a patient such as this, if she had a very clear T2 on endoscopic ultrasound, which may mean it's only a T1, and she had negative nodes, I would probably take her to surgery first, because in many instances, she might have been a stage 1 patient who never would have needed chemoradiation.
This would normally be the surgeon?
We have two people doing it. One of our colorectal surgeons does endoscopic ultrasound for their partner, and the others use our gastroenterologist. We have a wealth of people who can do endoscopic ultrasound.
Also, just before we get into the management of this woman, what was her trail in terms of getting diagnosed? Was it diagnosed rapidly? Was there a delay?
She actually had a pretty rapid diagnosis. She was seen by her family practitioner, sent her right off to a gastroenterologist who did a sigmoidoscopy. She elected to come to the University Hospital because she read up and she understood that quality of care was more important than easy access.
Are you saying that you can't get the same quality in the community?
Not in her community. The most proximate hospitals and doctors to her didn't have the same facilities that we do, and we're not that much further away.
Interesting. You know, it's so hard to tell when it really is in the patient's interest to go to a tertiary center. Obviously, there's a lot of sensitivity about that, and there are a lot of advantages to being treated in the community. So I guess it's important to pick out those situations. And yeah, I kind of get that feeling about rectal. How did you think through her options at that point?
As I said, if she had had a much earlier lesion by endoscopic ultrasound, because the tumor was high enough that our surgeons felt she could have undergone primary surgery and maybe not ever have needed chemoradiation, we elected to do chemoradiation because of her node-positive status. We knew she would get postoperative therapy, and we know from the German trial that the pre-op approach, at the very least, has better toxicity.
You mentioned that she was teaching. What was her family situation?
Married, 2 children.
How old?
Her children are in high school. She's also a church organist, which has something to do with some of the toxicity she's experienced with her treatment.
Interesting. So what happened?
So we have a study at our institution, which I think is still an interesting study 4 years later, of treatment immediately with capecitabine cetuximab. From the data from the Royal Marsden, where they gave chemotherapy alone before radiation, nobody progressed during treatment. Most people had response to whatever symptoms they were having, and most people had tumor shrinkage.
So this was 5-FU or capecitabine?
This was capecitabine, oxaliplatin, and so Xelox plus cetuximab.
Hmm.
2 cycles.
And now, is that what you were doing, or were you doing it concurrent with the radiation?
And then they get it concurrent with radiation.
And is that what you were doing?
And that's the study she went on.
Interesting. So it's 2 cycles of chemo alone?
Correct.
Chemo, cetuximab alone?
That's correct. And one of the reasons we chose that was not only for the theoretical advantages that might accrue from that, the other was that it's a pragmatic approach. We could start capecitabine, oxaliplatin, cetuximab that day,
right?
The next day. in our radiation department, she probably wouldn't have started treatment for at least 2 weeks.
So when was she diagnosed, or when did you see her?
Originally, it's been 4 years.
Oh, 4 years. Yeah. Okay, so those are the pre-KRAS days.
Correct.
So what happened with her?
So she went through treatment really quite well. In fact, her bleeding stopped as soon as we started the chemotherapy plus cetuximab.
Could you do any kind of objective evaluation of the tumor after the 2 cycles of the chemo cetuximab?
We elected not to do that. This was done within a protocol, and the costs would have been prohibitive.
How about physical exam?
Nothing on physical. Oh, in terms
did
of...
Did you feel it?
Our colorectal surgeon did before she started, yes.
Okay.
And they felt that the tumor was smaller, but of course they knew she had been treated, so there's some biases there.
Did she feel any different? Were her symptoms different?
Oh, yes. Yeah, her bleeding stopped.
How about her ability to, you know, have a bowel movement?
She was moving her bowels reasonably well.
So then what happened?
So then she got her chemo radiation therapy, tolerated it well. The oxaliplatin dosing during the radiation therapy was 50 milligrams per meter squared per week. So she didn't receive a lot of oxaliplatin, but she received some, and she had a grade 1 neuropathy by the time she went to the operating room. So she was restaged at the end of her chemo radiation therapy 6 weeks after it, because we don't operate in our institution before 6 weeks, and sometimes as long as 10 weeks after to allow for maximal tumor shrinkage, especially in a patient where sphincter preservation is an issue, not in this case. And at her evaluation, all she had left in her rectum was a small ulcer. And in the biopsy, there were some tumor cells of uncertain viability.
How about her nodes?
Her nodes by endoscopic ultrasound were negative at that point.
When she went to surgery?
She went to surgery, had a successful low anterior resection, did not require a colostomy. Her path at the end was a T1N0 tumor. Not a complete response, but a T1N0 tumor.
What was the next step then?
Well, then we had to discuss the issue of postoperative therapy. In the German trial, everybody got postoperative 5-FU and leucovorin, which was the standard of care when the study began. In her case, because of her node positivity at the start, and although we have prognostic information that significant downstaging generally means a good prognosis, we offered her 2 options. One was to continue, and that was in the protocol, you could offer options because the end point of the protocol was the downstaging part at surgery. Surgery was the end of the study, if you will. So the 2 choices are 5-FU alone or 5-FU leucovorin alone or FOLFOX, which is actually an E5204, the not very well accruing postoperative adjuvant trial.
Well, that's looking at Bev, right? FOLFOX Bev.
And there's bevacizumab in it as well.
That's surprising. It's not accruing well. The adjuvant Bev trials, there's a lot of interest in.
There are. I think that people generally in the rectal situation believe that whatever comes out of the colon trials will inform us as to what to do in rectal cancer, and therefore they don't feel impelled to accrue patients to the study.
Although I think one of the main reasons those studies have accrued so well, particularly the NSABP C08 colon study, which I think put 2,600 people in 2 years, is the thinking of, well, there is a residual risk of cancer recurrence even with chemo. Could I take a shot at something that probably is not going to make me sick, probably won't cause any major problems, maybe could help me? So it was very appealing to the patients and oncologists. I'm kind of surprised the rectal one doesn't go the same way.
Rectal studies have trouble accruing. It is a small population of patients. And sometimes what happens is in a setting where people are not on study for their preoperative therapy and then their surgery, approaching them after surgery with another decision to make may just be too much.
So also, just to clarify, you mentioned that this woman did have residual tumor. If she didn't, if she'd had a pathologic CR, I assume you still would have given her the adjuvant therapy at post-op.
I might have leaned more heavily toward recommending just single-agent fluoropyrimidines.
Right, because she had neuropathy at that point.
She had a grade 1, and so we discussed it. And she had a very high value on survival, on not relapsing. She's a young woman. Her children were still in high school. So she elected FOLFOX.
And I guess, what was her greatest concern about the neuropathy? You mentioned she was an organist. Was that her biggest concern?
Yeah, and I played the organ for a while, and you have to use your feet and your fingers, obviously, for the keyboard, but you also have to use your feet. And her primary neuropathy was more in her feet than her hands.
How is that affecting her ability to play the organ at that point?
Can't feel the pedals.
Wow.
sliding off the pedals.
So she couldn't really play.
So she played. She said it was just more difficult. And also because she was a gym teacher, she was the coach of the field hockey team. Field hockey gets played in cold weather during school.
Right.
And so she had to wear fur-lined boots because she could feel the typical cold sensory neuropathy.
But she was okay in terms of breathing the cold air in her face and all?
Yes. That typically only occurs right after the administration, but the cold sensitivity and the feeling of deadness in the feet can be much more accentuated by cold surfaces.
So how did she do in the adjuvant therapy?
So we planned six cycles, and she got four with FOLFOX, and her neuropathy started to get a little bit worse, and we just completed it the last two cycles with just LV5-FU2.
And what's her situation right now?
Right now she has no evidence of recurrence. She's being followed with CT scans every 6 months, obviously colonoscopies.
What's going on with her neuropathy?
Her neuropathy is there on cold days. She plays the organ. The parishioners in her parish are very happy that her neuropathy is basically gone. But on cold days, she still has to wear the fur-lined boots.
And what's your take in terms of where these two research strategies are heading that was utilized in the trial that she was in? First, oxaliplatin and rectal. Of course, that's being studied in the NSABP trial in a randomized fashion. What's going on right now? Do you use it outside of a protocol setting right now before we get these results?
We do. We offer it as an option to patients. We tell them what the standard is. Essentially, what we do is describe to them what the NSABP trial is. We've had a long experience. We did E1297. I was the study chair of that study, which looked at infusional 5-FU and biweekly oxaliplatin. So we have a long experience with it. There are many phase 2 trials, at least, that suggest higher pathologic CR rates with oxaliplatin, and it makes sense. Platinates are radiation sensitizers. So we offer it. We tell people the risks and benefits of doing it. We all wait for the NSABP trial. It's about two-thirds complete at the present time. So my guess is that at least the PATH CR rate data would be available, but not maybe for at least 2 or 3 years.
And the other strategy, which of course is really appealing, is the idea of treating with cetuximab during radiation therapy. Obviously, the results in head and neck cancer got people, lung cancers interested in it, colon cancer in terms of rectal is an obvious thought. Where are we right now in terms of data on that question and trials addressing that question?
There are a few studies also looking at cetuximab and radiation concurrently and separately from the radiation with chemotherapy. So, of course, we borrow from advanced disease. And one reason this study has been on hold since ASCO of 2008 is the evolving issue of KRAS. Certainly, we felt uncomfortable with continuing to accrue until we fully understood what we were doing and what the standard of care was going to be. We are now in the process of rewriting the protocol where only wild-type patients will get the cetuximab. We talked about what were the data of radiosensitization with cetuximab. Is it related to KRAS? Can we give it? We elected not to because there's not very strong data out there about KRAS prediction of radiation sensitivity. The other reason we did it is if one looks at trials with chemotherapy and EGFR agents in mutant patients, in some respects, they do worse. They actually have lower response rates and shorter PFS. So we were worried that without data fully supporting giving it with radiation therapy, we might actually be harming them. And we just didn't feel that was ethical.
So any other studies right now that are looking at this question?
There are a number of them. There's one in Great Britain. There's one at the Royal Marsden. There's one ongoing in Germany as well.
As long as we're talking about KRAS, what about BRAF? I'm hearing more about that. Is that getting close to being integrated into trials or even practice?
BRAF mutations are downstream from KRAS. The seminal paper for this was just published in the JCO not too long ago. And essentially what was found is that if a patient is wild type for KRAS, if they are mutated for BRAF, they will not respond. And even further downstream is PTEN. And we have three papers that will be coming out in the not too distant future on PTEN, where that is a further refinement. So we are chipping away at the number of patients who should be getting EGFR agents. You can look at it in the other direction because we're enriching the population who might actually benefit. So is it ready for prime time? At a recent panel that I participated in, I know that at least the Mayo Clinic and MD Anderson are now putting it in their panel with KRAS on a routine basis. and they are starting to integrate it into practice. The data for PTEN is much less certain. The studies are much smaller, but I think we are where we were with KRAS 3 years ago, perhaps.
So the numbers I've heard are 40% KRAS mutant, 10% BRAF. I don't know what the number for PTEN.
It's probably in the range of 10%.
Another 10, yeah. A different 10%.
A different 10%. So
and now 60%.
So we're now about 60% of people are going to be primarily resistant to EGFR agents. What it then means in the remaining 40%, for all the toxicities that the drugs cause, they have a much higher likelihood of response. It's still not predicting response, but you're enriching the population for those who could respond.
So any other strategies being looked at in a research setting in rectal cancer that you think maybe possibly could have some impact in clinical care in the next few years?
Yes, I think the biggest one actually is in the cooperative group system in the United States. There have been trials of laparoscopy versus open resection for colon cancer. Heidi Nelson's study showed that they were pretty much equivalent in terms of nodal gathering, in terms of overall outcomes. There was a British study, the CLOCK trial, that included rectal patients in their study, and they also showed that there was no difference. In the rectal subgroup, interestingly, the number of people with positive margins was higher in the group that had laparoscopy, but to date there's been no increase in local failure, potentially because patients received radiation therapy. So we felt in the United States, where technologies sometimes move quickly and get adapted quickly, particularly laparoscopy, that it was important to prospectively evaluate this in rectal cancer patients only. So the ACOSOG, the American College of Surgery Oncology group, proposed to the GI intergroup a direct comparison of laparoscopic surgery for rectal cancer versus open. And that study was approved. It is now open. Heidi Nelson and others are traveling around the country approving and certifying the centers that can do it. And I think this is a major step toward making sure that in the important rectal population, where local failure is one of our chief concerns, that we not simply assume that radiation therapy can make up for not adequate surgery.
How much does it decrease the morbidity to do it laparoscopically?
It actually increases OR time in some instances. It decreases, obviously, scars. At the beginning of laparoscopy, more than a decade ago, one thing that it clearly did do initially was to reduce time in hospital. At the end of Heidi Nelson's trial, what happened is that people moved faster with open procedures to get people out of the ambulate them, feed them, and get them out of the hospital. So that narrowed down to about a difference in a day as opposed to 3 or 4 days.
But I mean, somebody comes back to you post-op who's had laparoscopic surgery versus open surgery. What are they going to say? Are they going to say, will they describe less pain? You know, they got back to work faster. What would they say, you think?
In general, hemicolectomies done on an open basis don't leave people that ill or don't leave people that debilitated. It's not like having a Whipple procedure, gastrectomy, pancreas, whatever. So I think the differences are modest, and I think the real issue is when people get laparoscopic surgery, they probably need to go to a place that does it all the time and does it routinely.
You know, the other thing I wanted to get your take on now, you know, with ASCO coming out, blessing KRAS, is how it affects management in the first-line situation, and specifically selection of therapy in the patient who has a KRAS wild tumor, obviously in terms of the biologic. Do you have any cases in your practice that you could kind of present as a way to kind of get into how you think this through today?
So we still have about 50% of patients, let's say, at the moment, or 60% of patients, if one just addresses KRAS, who are wild type, who have the highest likelihood of benefiting from the addition of an EGFR agent. What do we know from clinical trials about upfront therapy with either FOLFIRI or FOLFOX with either cetuximab or panitumumab, and specifically cetuximab? Well, we have the CRYSTAL trial, which is the largest, with FOLFIRI plus or minus cetuximab. And the clearest message from that study is if one looks at the KRAS wild-type population, there's a big difference in response rate. Almost a 50% improvement in response rate, which is huge. And if one believes that a number of things, if one believes that response should relate to improvement in disease-related symptoms, one would think about choosing that therapy versus chemotherapy alone. If one thinks that one wants to downstage a patient for a liver resection, it would be reasonable to consider that regimen.
Although you're comparing it indirectly, I guess, to chemo-bev.
It's an indirect comparison, but the indirect comparison is that if one looks at FOLFOX, let me add one thing, is that we know from the CRYSTAL trial, which hasn't been published yet, that cetuximab clearly improved response rate and PFS with FOLFIRI. JCO on December 29th published Bockemeyer's OPUS trial, which was a smaller trial, but FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab, showing exactly the same thing. So the backbone is irrelevant. It's the KRAS mutational status and the EGFR agent that matters. However, if one looks at the Len-Salt study of FOLFOX or Zalox plus or minus bevacizumab, there was absolutely zero difference in response rate. The agents have different characteristics. Bevacizumab tends not to improve response rate when you have an active backbone such as FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. Response is not the issue. It's progression-free survival that is really the detectable endpoint. So they have different attributes that would lead you to select one or the other depending on the status of the patient.
But just to clarify, so it's your take. Obviously, we'd love to see a direct comparison in trial, but best we can do right now that you're going to get a better response rate with EGFR antibody compared to chemo-bev. What about progression-free survival and survival comparing those two strategies?
Well, we do have a study addressing that. It's 80405,
C80405. Except we don't have the answer from it yet.
We don't have the answer, but it was modified after ASCO last year to address wild-type patients only, and the direct comparison is FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, dealer's choice. 80% of people have chosen FOLFOX to date, as in the PACE trial. People either get bevacizumab or they get cetuximab or they get dual antibodies, which is somewhat difficult after the CAIRO2 trial and after publication of the PACE data in JCO 1229.
So I'll remind our listeners that CAIRO2 evaluated CAPOX plus bevacizumab with or without cetuximab, and the PACE study looked at FOLFIRI or FOLFOX plus BEV with or without panitumumab, and in both studies, the efficacy was decreased and the toxicity increased in the dual antibody arm. So based on the results of these trials, do you think that the dual antibody arm in the CALGB trial should have been closed?
I had a little difficulty with it. I'm reassured by the fact that the data up to the time of the study suspension at ASCO did not show a significant difference. So with the assurance that the DSMB is watching the study extremely carefully, I'm comfortable. I can live with it.
How many people are in the study so far?
I think there are about 1,400.
But getting back again to your best guess, what is your take in terms of progression-free survival and survival if you compare these two strategies, chemo-cetuximab to chemo-bev?
So in rank order, I think that in the direct comparison in the wild-type patient, in response rate, chemo-cetuximab will win. I think there's very little likelihood that they will not be significantly different. I think if one looks at progression-free survival, they may be roughly equal. One based on higher response and one based on the characteristics of bevacizumab, which is to prolong progression. In overall survival, which is what 80405 is powered for, I think there's not going to be a difference because people who don't get bevacizumab or cetuximab first may get it second, and therefore there'll be a washout. And I think it's going to be very difficult for that study to be positive for its primary endpoint, which is overall survival.
So then on the flip side, in terms of side effects and toxicity, how would you compare those two strategies?
Well, certainly there are going to be big differences in toxicity. There are the visible effects of cetuximab and also potentially higher toxicity, not just on skin, but on things like infection, which we saw in the PACE trial, where people get infections related to their skin. So indirect downstream events from skin. We don't have formal psychosocial testing, but certainly people are more uncomfortable when they receive EGFR agents. And so the trade-off in the endpoint at the end of the day is if the results of the study come out in the way I just suggested, if someone has a lot of tumor-related symptoms related to their primary tumor and need a response, then they will trade improvement in response, improvement in symptoms, for somewhat more toxicity. With bevacizumab, the symptoms are not palpable to the patient generally unless they get out of hand. So there'll be more management of hypertension. There may be other events that occur, some decrease in wound healing potentially. But in an asymptomatic patient, bevacizumab may be the preferred agent.
You know, it's interesting. I was interviewing your colleague Len Saltz recently, and I was just stunned. And we got into this issue about the dermatologic toxicity of the EGFR inhibitors. I actually had to edit some of the stuff out because it was just so strong, you know. But he really has a lot of feelings about it, about the social stigmatization. Being outside, you know, I talk to oncologists in practice. I talk to investigators. Obviously, cetuximab has been used in a lot of different situations. It's really hard for me to get a grasp on the personal impact of this because you hear such different viewpoints.
It's obviously very subjective, and patients sometimes tolerate very little toxicity, and sometimes they tolerate more than they should. So the answer to this is a lot has to do in the management of the skin toxicity when it occurs. So initially, of course, after the first 400 milligram dose, and then after the first 250 milligram dose, you've done the treatment, and people will get the toxicity they get. After that, a lot of it has to do with the management of it and the proper dose modification. So that we know from the Everest trial that if you push cetuximab to the highest tolerable level of skin toxicity, you get somewhat better results. But in the end, it probably isn't worth it because it's not going to be sustainable. The truth is that if you get proper skin care, there have been presentations of something called the STEP program that is a preordained prophylactic program rather than a reactive program. And if you do proper dose reductions, what you end up with are people who have a fine rash that if someone looks at them very closely, they may notice, but they can walk out on the street and don't need to wear bells around their neck.
You know, the other thing I wonder about is the whole paradigm for biologic therapy. You know, when we were more focused on chemo, at one point there was this concept, just treat, get as much as you can in and get them neutropenic, bring them to the edge in terms of side effects and toxicity. And now I'm starting to see things pop up in terms of biologic therapy that make me really think this thing through again. For example, of course, we have the issue of rash and dosing to rash. There was the Everest trial that was done in colon cancer looking at that. And I think there's a study going to look at that prospectively. The EGFR inhibitors in lung cancer, again, same thing, correlation with rash. You had a paper in the JCO a few months back in breast cancer looking at hypertension and SNPs and bevacizumab in these breast cancer patients showing preliminarily some interesting correlations. And then your competitor, The Lancet Oncology, had this wild paper that Jack Cusick wrote in breast cancer, and I interviewed him last month to get his take on it, seeming to correlate in breast cancer arthralgias and vasomotor symptoms with hormonal therapy and anti-tumor effect. Do you see sort of some kind of paradigm shaking out from this?
Let me tell you what I think would be an interesting approach to the toxicities of biologic might be, is cetuximab and panitumumab are active agents in their own right. They have certain toxicities that we don't like. I think of them potentially as induction agents. So reflect on the Optimox experience. There you have oxaliplatin, an agent that clearly has activity, that has toxicities we don't like if they're not managed. And so a study that I'd be interested in looking at is bevacizumab, to me, is a maintenance drug. It's something that prolongs, and you can argue the old bevacizumab beyond progression issue, but it's more of a maintenance drug that works with almost any chemotherapy. So taking from the Optimox trial of induction maintenance, I would be very interested. Let's say that FOLFOX-cetuximab turns out to be a very good treatment, okay? It has good response rates, whatever by whatever measure. Because of toxicity expense, is it something we really want someone to stay on forever and ever and ever? One protocol or one approach could be, as in Optimox, to give 6 to 8 cycles of FOLFOX-cetuximab and then drop out the oxaliplatin and the cetuximab and just continue fluoropyrimidine therapy.
I thought you were going to say bring in Bev.
It's another possibility, is introduction. If the story of dual antibodies hold up, yes, you wouldn't have put it in first line. And there's also a cost issue involved in this. You drop out then two of the expensive components of therapy for a trade-off for relatively inexpensive maintenance, which could even be capecitabine.
I think, too, this is a good segue into the last thing I want to ask you about, which is adjuvant therapy. And just to begin, in terms of your projections, based on what you just said about the way you conceptualize these drugs, about what we're going to see in the adjuvant trials, looking at EGFR antibodies and looking at Bev.
All right, I'll go out on a limb.
Go right out there. The year before the ATTACC trial, I asked everybody to predict what it showed.
Yeah.
And everybody predicted right except one person who I won't identify. He stuck with tamoxifen.
I don't want to go to that doctor. No. Well, that's a pretty good sampling, actually, then. So based on my concepts, at least, or my beliefs of how these agents work, and believing at heart that as difficult an endpoint response rate is, to me it's probably the best surrogate and predictor for what you're likely to see in the adjuvant setting. It's cytotoxicity you want. I don't know how PFS should ever impact on adjuvant therapy. That's not an endpoint that I know of. It's not a cytotoxic endpoint. It's more of a maintenance endpoint. So based on that, we'll know about CO8 in the not-too-distant future.
I can't wait to see that.
That could be a negative trial. I don't want negative trials, but it could be. Because if you just use the model, if you were designing today an adjuvant trial, and you looked at Len Salta's paper, and you saw that Zelox plus or minus bevacizumab, no difference in response rate, would you have designed a trial based on that?
Although the ability to go from the metastatic to the adjuvant setting, I guess it works most of the time, but
not always.
It
actually works pretty well, because if you look at IFL, for example, it was only modestly better than 5-FU and leucovorin, and it didn't show benefit. And if you look at the results of PETOC-3, for example, what it says, I think what PETOC-3 and MOSAIC together say is that FOLFIRI is just slightly less cytotoxic, but you've never proven it in the advances he said, and nor do I ever want to.
Yeah, I remember in 2005, I interviewed Edith Perez in January, and she just stunned me, because I don't know if you remember, at that point, nobody had any idea when the Herceptin studies were going to report. And she said, well, the NCI decided to combine the two trials, the NSABP and the intergroup study, and I think we're going to report at ASCO. And then I remember in April waking up one day and seeing the press release, which nowadays is the first evidence we have, showing those studies work. And I guess I just think it seems like the NSABP adjuvant Bev colon study is such a huge trial for oncology. I mean, this is not just about colon cancer. There's Absolutely. Adjuvant trials in breast and in lung, and just biologically our understanding. And I just imagine the scenario waking up and seeing press release saying nothing, zero. Press release saying huge trastuzumab-like yes. bump. I mean, who knows? It seems like nobody really knows.
Well, in the end, the data are the data. I think what we do know is that it was done by a highly experienced group.
Yep.
It's an impeccably done study. And whatever the results are, it's not going to be the result of a bad trial.
And I guess the AVANT trial is out there too, which is also looking at that, but they're probably not going to report it soon.
No, because it's a three-arm study,
right.
So it's more complicated, and it has, that's FOLFOX versus FOLFOX Bev versus Zelox Bev. So there's another question embedded within it.
So let's chat just a little bit about adjuvant therapy. And I don't know if there's any patient you might want to just bring up, just to bring out on the table, so maybe as a way to get into how you think it through.
Sure. Well, to address the other antibody, I can do that
within okay.
the context of that. As a patient who came with stage 3 colon cancer, 3 of 14 positive nodes,
how
pretty straightforward, 60s. Pretty straightforward.
What kind of work, background?
Actually, business executive type.
So he came in there with 3 positive nodes?
Mm-hmm.
What was his sort of family situation?
Married, kids in college.
Was he one of these get out on the internet, try to figure out what's going on, or more like just tell me what to do?
Tell me what to do, doc.
So what'd you tell him to do?
I approached him with N0147, the intergroup trial, FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab. And he was very open to randomization. I think he was right in the right socioeconomic class and educational class that he was open to the idea of participation in clinical trials. And he was randomized to the cetuximab arm. He's on it now. All of us are now affected by issues related to leucovorin. Luckily, our hospital has about a 6-month supply, but as you know, everybody has been shunting their existing leucovorin into the adjuvant setting and sometimes having to delete it in the advanced disease setting, a rather bizarre situation.
Totally. And how far into the cetuximab or the treatment is he right now?
It's about 3 months. He's about halfway through.
How's he doing in terms of side effects? How's his skin?
He didn't have much of a rash. I don't think it was ever more than a grade 2. And right now, I think if you walked by him on the street, you'd probably just think he had fair skin with a little modeling, and that's about it. He's fine with it.
How did he feel? Did he have any preferences in terms of randomization, or either way it was okay with him?
No, he was okay either way. He was okay. And, you know, so at the end of the day, do I have a belief system about what NO147 will show? Well, if I look at the data from Crystal and I look at the data from Opus and I see response rates of 59% versus 38%, I have sort of an opposite feeling. I'd be surprised if it were a negative trial, because now it's restricted to wild-type patients. So you've now enriched it. I mean, I'd like both of them to be positive. Then I don't know what we're going to do, because we'd end up maybe thinking of direct comparisons. Who knows? The other chain of thought that I'd like to put in is that there are, I think, 4 ongoing studies, unfortunately, each of them somewhat underpowered, looking at 3 versus 6 months of FOLFOX adjuvant therapy. Because obviously, the big issue we're always dealing with is neuropathy. And my general practice is the best way to prevent neuropathy is not to cause it. So I generally will delete the oxaliplatin if I'm at least at cycle 8 and then just continue out to 4 more cycles of LV5-FU2. What's happening now is Dan Sargent and others are trying to do a prospective pooled analysis by aligning the 4 existing trials together, the one from Scotland, there's one in Italy, there are 2 other sites, to hopefully have enough patients, because you need about 8,000 patients to show non-inferiority. And unlike an advanced disease, where you probably could live with up to a 20% inferior regimen, in an advanced disease, we've spent a long time gaining 2 or 3 percentage points. In breast cancer, that would be a strongly positive trial. You don't want a regimen that's more than 2 or 3% less good than the longer treatment.
What about the issue of combined biologics, EGFR antibody with Bev? Obviously, there's a lot of discouragement now because of the PACE study, and then more recently, as you mentioned, the CAIRO-2 study. But, I mean, there is sort of an intuitive or inherent, you know, appeal to using 2 active agents. What about the strategy of sequential therapy? We're seeing that in the adjuvant HER2 breast setting with the ALTO study, where they're using trastuzumab and lapatinib. And one of the arms is 1 first, I think it's trastuzumab, followed by lapatinib. What about that in colon cancer?
I've been thinking that through, because I'm always trying to think of what study I would do if I could do it. And so you're right. If they can't live together, how should they live separately? And so one approach could be, for example, is if your belief is you want a big hit up front for micrometastases, and you still are doing 12 cycles of FOLFOX, for example, and if CO8 is positive and an 0147 is positive, you could have 12 cycles, and in the first 6 give cetuximab, and in the second 6 give bevacizumab.
There was a point in time, I think, when the NSABP was thinking about the follow-up study after CO8, and, you know, like, say, maybe assume it's positive, and what would the study be, get it started. Yeah. And, of course, at that point, they were thinking about combined biologics.
That was
and
that
just sort of C10, right? So that kind of fell off. Or people waiting to see the adjuvant Bev or see the adjuvant cetuximab, or are there already designs that are moving forward?
At the moment, they're just waiting, obviously, for at least CO8 because it's so close.
So, you know, we could have gotten an entire adjuvant diet exercise study done while we've been waiting for all this.
Intervention studies like that are difficult.
I know.
The CALGB is proposing a vitamin D Celebrex study.
I just want to see the tissue and the sera on people, you know, and let's not worry about it. Just try to do something. Why aren't we doing it? I mean, a lot of the oncologists in practice, for example, the ones who put these people on CO8, are really frustrated that there's no major adjuvant study other than the one that you mentioned with cetuximab.
Right. I think there are times where you have to take a breath. And I think we used to do studies just to do studies, and sometimes you have to have a question. The CALGB trial is under active consideration. It's vitamin D, not vitamin D. It's a lot of it's based on Charlie Fuchs's and Jeff Meyerhart's data from earlier studies, and I think that may go through. There's also a Celebrex question. We'll never get the Vioxx question answered, so maybe the Celebrex question can be answered.
I know I was chatting with Ed Lynn yesterday about celecoxib in terms of the issue of, as he calls it, stemness or stem cell effect. I'm not sure I quite understood it. I think I did, but where do you think that's heading?
I don't know. I know even less than you probably.
I know. It was like, what are you talking about?
One comment I do have related to what you said earlier in terms of diet and exercise.
Right.
Certainly at the journal, we have done our share and maybe more of publishing data in colon and breast, showing some very strong trends, recognizing that most are retrospective or prospectively collected data from clinical trials, showing very strong themes that have biologic underpinnings, especially related to insulin-like growth factors. Almost every study, I don't think there's a negative cohort retrospective study of any kind that doesn't show that people that exercise do better in breast and colon. People that maintain weight, who either enter treatment lean or exit treatment lean, do better.
Do better meaning less cancer recurrence.
Exactly.
I mean, that's major.
And if you look at the data, again, these are not the same as prospective intervention trials. If you look at the data, quite frankly, the impact of doing those things, and which is why I recommend them in practice, is higher than anything you would expect from the next biologic. It just is. And so I think it's important because people always ask, you know, what can I do to improve my outcome? Sometimes that translates into what drug can you give me to magically make things better? The truth is that it's what they really can do, which is change their diet. I am a believer, in spite of the Health Prevention Task Force recommendation, that aspirin should not be recommended. You know, there's just hardly been a single study that has not shown that an aspirin a day of whatever strength is not associated with reduced risk of at least colon polyps and colon cancer.
Well, you know, I have to say now, just kind of taking a step back, thinking of all the things that you've talked today about and also how KRAS has affected things, that, you know, maybe people haven't paid enough attention to that intergroup study. I mean, I'm thinking specifically about a couple of the docs I know who were so excited about C08. Maybe they'd be more excited about this cetuximab if they kind of, I mean, maybe they're kind of not really appreciating the potential of that maybe. You know, because I know what got them excited about C08 was that maybe my patient will benefit. And, you know, you just in the last hour made a pretty good argument for the fact that maybe people in this adjuvant study might benefit.
Oh, I think they are. And I think that one way or the other, hopefully with both biologics, we'll move forward and take the next step. And as I said, the next step is going to be, as in many successful measures, for example, in pediatric malignancies is the classic example, is how do you maintain at least the same benefit with fewest toxicities? So shortening therapy, sequential biologics, it may not always improve the one endpoint we all look for, which is overall survival. But in many tumors, we discussed this at the GI intergroup, the most difficult task forces we have, for example, is the GIST task force. For them to design a study has become almost impossible. It's like CML.
I was going to say CML is the same thing.
It's like testicular cancer. When was the last testicular cancer study you saw? At a certain point, you have to acknowledge that you succeeded with the tools you have.
I know. I remember one of the hematologists I interviewed recently who said, how do you randomize against magic? You know,
exactly.
When you talk about first-line CML. But, you know, getting back to this thing, it's interesting. Of course, we never know what these trials are going to show. We're constantly being surprised. But, you know, obviously, docs are just scrambling. They're looking at people who they know have high residual relapse rates and trying to think, what could I maybe offer them? I don't want to be sitting in the audience at ASCO like I was for the adjuvant trastuzumab studies and thinking all about all the people who didn't get treated, who maybe, you know, could have benefited. And again, thinking back to what you've said in terms of the argument that you put together, it's interesting. You know, we do these surveys all the time. We always send one into ASCO or, you know, whatever, just to give people a little glimpse of what's going on. And the one we sent in last year in 2008 was a study actually focusing on oncologists in practice, asking them not only what they offer to their patients, but what they would do if they were patients themselves. And one of the things that I remember as I've been talking to you is a strong preference they had if they were going to participate in a study. We said, suppose there was an adjuvant Bev study and an adjuvant cetuximab study. Strong preference for both their patients and themselves to do the adjuvant Bev study. And now, you know, again, listening to what you're saying and thinking about maybe what we might see and the ability, as in your patient, to maybe mitigate side effects, that maybe, again, they ought to be thinking more about these adjuvant EGFR antibody studies. I guess that's just cetuximab at this point.
Well, at the very least, if people really have in their head that they want things to move forward, the one driving force in wanting to complete as ASAP N0147 is what you don't want. I mean, as Oscar Wilde said, you know, be careful for what you wish, you might get it, is for NO147 to be in the position of having a positive CO8 trial.
And then affecting whether people go on the study.
Totally.
Right.
Totally.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So the timing is impeccable. I mean, you can't orchestrate these things. They happen when they happen. But if I were running the world, I would say, please don't tell us the results of CO8 until NO147 is complete. But that, of course, is something you can't do. It's something that has to happen naturally and biologically. I think it actually will happen. Accrual is good on NO147. It's now only the wild-type patients, 1,000 patients. When you look at it, back, it's now 20 years. It's a little scary since I did intergroup 089. When intergroup 089 was open, and there were three big studies open, North Central, NSABP and intergroup 089, they all asked the similar sorts of questions. It may have been very profligate of us. But at the peak accrual, we had 450 patients a month going on study.
Wow.
A month. My peak was 175 patients in 1 month on the intergroup study. So the patients are out there, and I hope people do get excited. And as I said, the impetus is, if they really want to participate in moving things forward, is to make sure NO147 is complete, and whatever the results are the results, but at least that it's done, that we're not left unsatisfied. Because it will, I see no way that a positive CO8 trial is not going to somehow affect accrual.